Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's about learning, praying, and acting. I mean, folks, we've got to get up and acknowledge the fact that we're going to have to do it. So it's all, what we're doing, it's all about full compliance with the Constitution, getting every public servant and holding them accountable to their oath of office. That's what it's all about. I don't want to make it, you know, this really convoluted thing. It's really not, but understanding the Constitution, which is why we go through all these documents, so that we can really help you through these different documents that we've read, from the ratification debates as well as the Constitutional Convention, Madison's notes. And, oh, by the way, let me bring Sean and Tammy, because we got Tammy back. And so Tammy has returned from her world tour. And so we're all back together. And what we're going to do is we're going to take turns. And so Tammy and Sean are going to kind of share. And I think this will help, hopefully lend to proving what Tammy has learned. Or if she doesn't, you know, she has another question or needs more clarity, then having more people. Folks, I would love to do this in a much larger venue where, you know, you could dial in and call or what have you. As a matter of fact, feel free. If there's a question, we've covered something, and you want us to go back and say, you know, can you re-explain this, you said this, or what have you? And I may even pull up the actual show if you tell me what show it is, and we'll, you know, play what I said so I can either clarify or defend or what have you. But anyway, because there's a good likelihood, if my mouth is functioning, as far as at least my wife is concerned, I'm probably misspeaking. So anyway, so welcome, both of you. And folks, we left off. Thank you. And Sean, I think we were just diving into the admission of new states, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. So with that, let's dive into Section 3. And so there's literally two paragraphs here. We've got the power itself, or actually, if we were looking, as a matter of fact, I'd even encourage you folks at home, when we go through this, you should have both color-coded constitutions open. One that's identifying the violations, and the other one's identifying exactly what is this. Is this a power being granted to Congress? No, it's not. There is a power that is being granted as an ancillary power to this, because what this is it's a role and responsibility for Congress to admit new states into the Union. In other words, out of the federal government, there are three branches. And out of those three branches, it could be the judiciary that admits new states into the Union, but the framers didn't do it that way. It could be the executive, but they didn't do it that way either. They basically left it to Congress. And I'm telling you, the reason why, folks, is because the legislative bodies are the sovereigns within our government. If you understand what I just said, then you should have a very good grasp on the fact that in our form of government, it is a Republican form of government, which means our legislatures are those people who we go to. They're the ones that if we have a problem for redress, we go to them. We don't run into the court over every problem. And so to be clear, then you realize today, because everybody goes to the court, somehow we've been converted into a judiciary form of government. And that's wrong. That's unconstitutional. Again, so that's why I hope you understand that Congress has a role here to admitting new states into the Union. So we're going to dive into this, into the details. The second portion, or the second subsection, they didn't break this into one and two. because the first paragraph is literally subsection one. The second paragraph is subsection two. And I wish they would have done that, but like they did with other places, but they didn't. So let's go ahead and let's break this down to where we'll just dive into the details of the whole thing. So, Sean, why don't you read this whole first section with, you know, because it's broken down by the semicolons. And I think we can just dive into it afterwards. So you read it, and then I'll kind of highlight those parts and what they're saying and what they're doing, if that makes sense. So let's try it that way. And then, Tammy, you get the second clause or second stanzas, so that everybody gets their fair share. But anyway, go ahead, Sean. Let's start off with the first paragraph.
Article 4, Section 3. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of state, without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned, as well as of the Congress.
Okay, so basically the role is given to Congress. That's the very first line. It is your responsibility, Congress, to admitting new states into the Union. And in so doing, you cannot admit new states that are formed or erected within a state. So when you look at these little states of Sharia law, technically that's not been admitted into the Union, but the fact that the states are allowing a separate sovereignty, a separate legal system to exist within the state is literally unconstitutional. The legal system literally needs to be maintained by the whole state, that the state has the responsibility of ensuring everybody has equal protection under the law. That's the 14th Amendment. It demands that all people have equal protection. So if you trip yourself into a Sharia law state within a state, and they tell you that you can't, you know, they tell you can't sell something there, like you can't bring your bacon in and sell it. It's illegal to sell bacon here. And they, if they try to punish you, but the fact that they're not letting you sell bacon on that block where they've invoked Sharia law, then you have a right to go to the state and say, hey, they've created a law that abridges my privileges and immunities, and what are you going to do about it, state? Because the Sharia law, technically, what they're doing is actually undermining the Constitution. Okay, so as they look at all the other parts and so forth, the key thing is, if it's coming from an existing state, they need the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned, as well as Congress. So Congress has to basically buy off in admitting the state into the Union, but they need approval of the existing state to say, we'll allow it. Now, that we talked earlier, Sean, about a situation where Virginia had two states join the Union from it, right? We talked about Kentucky and West Virginia. So when Kentucky was created, the state of Virginia actually gave consent to Congress to say, we'll allow this state to, you know, separate from us, or this territory to separate and be formed into a new state. That was a formal process that actually occurred. That didn't happen with West Virginia. Why?
I do not know.
Tammy. Got any?
I don't know.
Okay, so
Civil War,
because of the war, but because Virginia was no longer a state in the Union, they weren't a state; they were autonomous.
Okay,
right. So when a part of the Western Virginia people said, "Hey, we want to be a part of the Union. We don't want to go with them," when they severed the fact that they left the Union and the allowance of West Virginia to join. Who says that the states didn't leave the Union? Because if Lincoln was right, and Lincoln said you can't leave the Union, then based on the Constitution, they would have needed the state of Virginia's legislature to approve the severance of West Virginia into the Union. And that didn't happen because Virginia did leave the Union. And this helps, this helps people realize that those states left the Union. Lincoln was playing games and saying, no, you didn't, because I'm not allowing it. Like he was the king. And it was almost like Lincoln was saying, that's not the sun. It's just a very bright moon tonight. You know, and oh, but the moon gets darker, you know, in a few hours from now, and then it'll get bright again. But the sun doesn't exist anymore. We just have the moon. That's like saying that kind of an assertion. I mean, Lincoln was literally defying the law and reality because he was making it up as he goes along because he was doing everything he can to not have his presidency marred in this huge failure that the Union dissolved itself on his watch. So, Tammy, let's go ahead. Any other comments on that first part?
Nope. Okay. Congress. The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state.
Okay, so the very first part, let me break this down. Congress shall have the power to dispose of this territory. Now, they have the authority to dispose of it, let's say, because it's a territory, maybe it's not fully developed and it's not being admitted into the Union. If it's coming into the Union, then they will dispose of it by making it'll become its own state. In other words, it will no longer be a territory of the United States. It will become a state and a part of the Union, where it becomes a part or a party to the compact. So when a state joins the Union, they're agreeing to all of the other states that are in the Union that they too will abide by that same Constitution and all the amendments that have been made to this point, and work with them in holding this creature called the federal government accountable to that Constitution. So in other words, this is like adopting a new parent into the family. It's one to many, not one to one. And everybody today has been taught, or they somehow believe, that when states join the Union, they're committing to the federal government. And one of the reasons that is because when you read the state constitutions after the Civil War, the federal government demanded that you put a line in your constitution, that's in Wyoming's, that this state is an inseparable part of the Union, that it will not leave the Union without the federal government's consent. They can't do that. The federal government can't do that. It gives its authority, that wipes out the authority of the party. Madison covers this in the Virginia resolutions, specifically in his report on them. But the next part of this says, and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or property or other property belonging to the United States. So they kind of created this caveat that went along with Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, that Congress should have the power of exclusive legislation over the District of Columbia, as well as all these other properties. They basically married this into any property that is the federal government's, and at this point in time, because it's under the stewardship of the federal government, this territory, they can make all needful rules and regulations respecting the, not state, it doesn't say state, not new state, it says territory. In other words, that is the status of that property at that point in time. Once they've been admitted as a state, they come into the Union with full equal footing, full sovereignty. All their land is theirs. If the federal government is going to possess any land, the Constitution is now invoked that they want to have a fort, they want to maintain a fort they created as this territory is transitioned into a state, then the federal government would have to go and say, hey, we've got a fort there, or an arsenal, or a magazine, a storage of munitions, and we want to keep that, so we need your consent, and we have to pay for it. We have to buy that from you. So how much do you want for it, and we need your permission. Can we do this? Because if not, then we'll have to vacate that arsenal and move it somewhere else to another state. If that state was, no, we don't want you doing that. We're going to have our own militia. Because Tammy and I kind of covered this in the ratification debates as well as the Constitutional Convention, that as the states started joining the union, and actually I think Sean and I covered this as well, so now we can cover it collectively, that when these new states were joining the union, the federal government didn't care about helping them set up a militia. They weren't holding their hands and making them become self-sufficient. In other words, they were already starting, we'll take care of you from cradle to grave, already starting that little mantra. This next part, because it basically says that they only control regulating the territories and property belonging to the United States, needful shipyards, needful buildings, but that's it. If it is a within a state and it's not within the enumerated objects that the federal government can possess that land in the state. So, folks, there's nowhere in the Constitution that allows them to have a conservatory, you know, for wetlands or a forest or a park. There's nothing in the Constitution granting the federal government the ability to have a reservation to host people on.
Right. Plus all the land that is supposedly federal land.
Yeah.
Isn't pastures at all.
Well, so, and both Sean and you, Tammy, weren't in the content that I was covering with the land purchase acts and those types of things, where the federal government basically after Indiana, or actually it was after Illinois joined, and it was during the Missouri Compromise period in 1820, they passed this land purchase and sales act, where they basically told the states that have joined the union, which means Missouri, Illinois, Mississippi, Indiana, Louisiana, Ohio, Mississippi, all of these states that had joined the union at this point in time had to give up a 500,000 acres at minimum. At a minimum, they had to give up a 500,000 acres each state to the federal government to sell that land. And when the federal government sold the land, if they sold the land, they would give the proceeds to the state where the land was sold so that it would help them build their infrastructure in connecting their state to the other states to D.C. And the rest of the money was Congress's to use to bolster up the D.C. area to do what they wanted to do. This right there was an unconstitutional act. And what they did, even though the states went along with it, the states just said, you don't have the authority to do this, because they didn't. And this is actually when there was a big surge in America in trying to understand the Constitution. This is when John G. Jackson went to James Madison and said, hey, would you please release your notes? Because Yates has actually released the notes of the Constitutional Convention from William Jackson. So William Jackson was the secretary of the convention. And he started taking notes, but his notes died. He stopped doing them. And I don't know why. I think he went back to the state or whatever, and nobody took on the responsibility because everybody knew Madison was doing it because Madison was making his own notes. And so Yates basically took William Jackson's notes and basically started interpreting and actually injecting a whole bunch of stuff. And so I actually downloaded, and I'm going to post these up for you, because what they did was they consolidated all of the notes, Madison's, Jackson's, and Yates' editorials, into this huge document called the Constitutional Convention, the notes and the record of the Constitutional Convention. And to be interesting here, folks, is you can actually see Yates claiming and pointing to Madison as a devious man trying to annihilate the states and so forth. And actually, when Yates was doing this, he was publishing this in 1808. And he was doing this because he was doing everything he could to keep Madison from becoming the next president. Where was Yates from? You know, I don't expect you to know. Yates was from New York. Another shenanigan player out of New York. And actually, the thing that floored me was it was Alexander Hamilton's son who actually stood up in defense of Madison at that point and said, hey, You know, this is basically a political play that Yates is doing to try to denigrate Madison in his run for presidency. So anyway, the whole point is, if you go through this, because what I've been trying to do is I've been trying to create more of a authoritarian notes on the convention. And I found this and I go, wow, this is great, because this is including William Jackson's. But come to find out, they literally repeat everything in this. So they play one person's, you know, account, then they play another person's account. And actually, because Madison was incorporated into Yates's work, because somehow, I don't know how they got it, but somehow, no, it wasn't Yates's work, it was done later. And so when you read this, it's just like so duplicative that it's really hard. It's absolutely impossible to really, you know, stay on, because didn't I just read this kind of thing constantly? And I said, you know what, I'm not even going to, this is a quagmire. And so one of the things that they basically concede, and for the most part all the historians have conceded, that Madison's notes were the most thorough. The one thing that happened when William Jackson's papers were published, Madison basically told people that he was changing his notes because there were certain things in Jackson's notes that he didn't have. So, like, when we read Madison's notes, because I don't know if you remember, that talked about, you know, how the states voted by delegation on a particular motion, right? They passed this state, failed this state. That accounting, Madison originally did not do. He incorporated that from Jackson's because Jackson was keeping track of that. Madison's focus was trying to maintain clarity on what was being said and how it was being said. So, in other words, he was really giving us the most accurate picture of how they were debating everything. So I'm diving into this historical view, but the whole point on all of this is that when we look at the admission of states into the Union, because the ratification debates really did not address this. This was only addressed in the Constitutional Convention. We're better off sticking with Madison's notes because that dialogue was kept more accurately by Madison, where Jackson's records and all the other records that have been thrown into this were, you know, post after the fact, like what Yates did. Yates basically 10, 15 years later started writing down his view of what happened at the convention. And so, interestingly enough, one of the rules at the convention was everybody could inspect the secretary's notes to ensure on a daily basis that it was an accurate record. That didn't even play that well because everybody just, you know, we're still making it up as we go along kind of thing. So it wasn't that important till the very end. And then everybody realized, well, you're not even keeping notes. So anyway. You know, these guys did everything they could. And actually, that the same thing happened with the ratification debates for the most part, because after the scribes, you know, actually consolidated the ratification debates, then it was available to all of the delegates so that they could go check it. And for the most part, there was really, I mean, there was a little squabbling here and there, but for the most part, there was no hard rejecting of any of the ratification debates, which is why the ratification debates are so important. But when it comes to this part of the Constitution, there it was completely accepted, this concept of states joining the Union with full sovereignty, that they would be just like another state in the Union. Just like all the other states, they would not have any diminished sovereignty. And that was completely expected.
Right.
And so, Tammy, did you go through any of the Enabling Acts with me, or was it only I that did that? And we're going into a break here, but any idea? Do you remember?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So what we're going to do is, when we come back from break, is I'm going to grab the Ohio Enabling Act, and I'll send it to you and Sean, so that when we come back, we can kind of take a look at that, because it's pretty short and to the point. And I was going to bring in Louisiana, but I don't want to confuse everything. So when we come back from break, folks, We'll go through the Enabling Act so you can see the equal footing.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so without any further ado, we've got the... Everybody has it. And as a matter of fact, folks, this is actually on Reclaiming the Republic on the Academic Source Documents page. This is the Enabling Act for Ohio Statehood. And so as they basically lay it out, this is an act of Congress recognizing the state of Ohio, 1803, an act to provide for due execution of the laws of the United States within the state of Ohio, whereas the people of the eastern division of the territory northwest of the River Ohio did on the 29th day of November, 1802, form for themselves a constitution and state government. So in other words, the work has been done, and this is basically the Admission Act, right? And so, and did give the said state the name, the state of Ohio, in pursuance of an act of Congress entitled An Act to Enable the People of the Eastern Division of the Territory Northwest of the Ohio to form a constitution and state government, and for the admission of such state into the Union on an equal footing with original states and for all other purposes, close quote, whereby the said state has become one of the United States of America, in order, therefore, to provide for the due execution of the laws of the United States within the state of Ohio. Now, before I go into anything else here, is it not obvious that the state actually had to determine what they were going to call themselves? They basically said, hey, we're giving you the authority to go and to turn this territory into whatever state you want to call it and form your constitution and create your government, so that you can be admitted into the Union. And when you're admitted, you'll be admitted with the full equal footing as all other states. So, as I go down and I look at Section 1, and it talks about being enacted, the Senate, the House of Representatives of the United States of Congress assembled, that the laws of the United States were now... which are not locally inapplicable, shall have the same force and effect. So basically they're just saying now all the laws of the United States will be in effect, because as the territory was formed, they didn't have right of representation. They didn't have some of the rights as a state. And so they didn't have to pay taxes. State and territories did not have to pay taxes. So all the laws that are applicable to a state will now be applicable to the state of Ohio. And be it further enacted that the said state shall be one district and called the district or the Ohio district, and a district court shall be therein. So in other words, they were creating a federal district court. And so when you go through this, the rest of this is really setting up the judge and how he's to be paid out of the treasury, because if you look at Section 3, it says, and it should be further enacted that there should be allowed to the judge of the said district, the court of the said district court, the annual compensation of $1,000 to commence from the date of his appointment, to be paid quarterly, yearly, at the Treasury of the United States. So, in other words, the United States government was going to pay this guy. So, in other words, this was a formal appointment of a federal judge to that state. They may have had one to the territory. It was probably the same guy. And I don't think, I think I might have mentioned this before to Tammy, but it's worth mentioning again. The people, the judges that they were bringing out to the territory, you know, they had to sweeten the pot to get these guys to go out there. And when you look at $1,000 a year for a judge back in 1803, that's a handsome pay. So anyway, there's a total of five sections. There's really nothing else here other than the fact that they needed to have federal marshals to help ensure that the enforcement of the laws were being done by the states. Because that was the whole point of the marshals. That's why when we look at the Whiskey Rebellion, we'll find that the marshals were basically going out to the sheriffs and saying, you know, we need to start collecting this whiskey tax or this distilled liquor tax. And this is how we need to do it. And so they kind of went together and laid out, you know, how each business manufacturer of distilled liquors needed to pay the tax. And all the states were had no problem except for Western Pennsylvania, or basically the Northwest Territory area, this area. So anyway, so the point is that there's no mention of any land here, folks. There is no mention that you have to take so much acreage and set it aside for education. You have to take so much acreage and set it aside for us to sell your land.
Right.
They came in full holders, full cognizance, full authority over every square inch of that state. The state government had basically been given its full sovereignty over this state when it came into the Union. Now, I'll invite everybody to go look at Louisiana. I don't want to take the time in going through the details and nuances.
Hey, come on down, Chef.
Pardon me? Go ahead. What's that?
I said, come on down, Chef.
Okay. So the point is in the Louisiana Enabling Act, there are all of the nuances of the Louisiana Treaty in that, because Spain had specific privileges of trade agreements with Louisiana and the United States, and same with France. They were the only two, so it was mentioned in there, and they had to basically say, hey, we created this treaty, and you have to honor the treaty with both Spain and France in not taxing them and so forth, that they're not subject to your taxes. Because once a state becomes a state, it can actually start taxing, but they said you can't do that on these very specific, because of these treaties. So anyway, I don't want to convolute it because it is a little bit longer because of that. I was going to use that, but folks, if you look at that and you actually look at, you know, there's nothing in the Louisiana State Enabling Act that identified, you know, that you have to set aside land or we're controlling this, you got to do these. They nothing like that. It wasn't until the next state in 1816, which was Indiana, in joining the Union. And that's when the federal government started basically saying, you got to do this, you can't sell this, or you can't sell these salt mines, and so forth. We covered this in Why Counties Matter Most. So if you've read that, then you can see, because I spell out what parts of the Enabling Act are direct violations. Congress is assuming authority they don't have. Okay, so I think I've kind of covered the horse in mud, but it's still dead.
I had a question. I mean, it might be going back a little bit, but It was sticking with me. When we were talking about secession,
yeah,
and how Lincoln said that you can't, and maybe it actually did. Uh-huh. So why do you think the framers didn't even consider that, or did they? And it's just not mentioned anywhere.
Well, so actually,
anyone wanting any state leaving the Union did they just not consider it?
No. Actually, it was identified. Not in the Constitution. It was identified in the ratification debates. The ratification debates basically said, hey, at any point in time that the federal government starts breaching the compact, you know, it is a known thing that any breach of a compact, whether it be one line or the entire thing, you know, it is the entire thing, because the compact itself is predicated upon all the lines in it. And so if they're breaching one part, then any state has the ability to void the contract and basically secede. That was right. Clearly
so
stated.
They didn't have to mention it because that's just basic contract law.
There you go. Absolutely. Absolutely. And actually, it was also in the Federalist Papers, like, because Madison stated it in both documents identically. And so it was probably in that particular oration that was very, very clear, because Madison probably said it the best. But bottom line, you go into this compact as a willing party, but you cannot be compelled, you cannot be forced to stay in it. So Lincoln was wrong, because even Lincoln didn't even read the Federalist Papers, because I believe, I'd have to pull it up, but I think it's somewhere in the 40s. I think that's where Madison identifies the breach of the compact. That if it's been breached, one line been breached, then it's considered the whole thing. And that any state can basically nullify the compact and step out. It's like, this is when we learn more about this in going through the interposition documents of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions,
right,
where they talk about we need to interpose, not nullify. If you nullify, you have to step out. As a matter of fact, Madison was emphatic. If you're not going to follow one law, then you need to leave the union.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, basically, if a state left the union, let's just say, hypothetically, a state left the union, then this is where it gets kind of convoluted, then would they have to rewrite the Constitution or do anything to adjust the contract? Or it would just be that person is no longer included?
So when a state joins
the person, but state, you understand? What
yeah,
I mean.
So when a new state joined the Union, Sean, they didn't add that state to any part of the Constitution by name. It just became a new party to the Constitution, and the Union was extended into that state. It just became a perfunctory administrative process. So whether the state comes or whether the state goes doesn't really matter. The reason why the state leaves is very material. They can't walk away when the Constitution is being followed. They can only walk away when the Constitution is being violated. Now, this is important, because when we look today, if we start executing Republic Review and force the federal government into full compliance, and some of these left-wing wacko states say, well, we don't like this, we consider this a breach of the compact, you know, you need to give us the welfare and everything else, and if you're not, we're going to leave. We're going to basically nullify what you're doing and actually secede from the union. Well, they can't. Because we're actually getting them into compliance and not doing the things they're not supposed to do. You can't leave because right. The federal government is finally becoming compliant.
Right, I got you.
Okay, there you go. Because
we're leaving the union because you won't let us break the contract.
Right. And so, when the federal government was actually conducting tariffs and economic warfare on the southern states, the southern states could have actually left the union. That's what they should have done. That's what Madison said. And he talks about the Calhoun nullification concept, and he goes, it's wrong. You can't nullify. You can't choose and pick what laws you want to follow. If you're not going to follow the laws of the union, you need to step out. If there's one law you're not going to follow, then you need to step out. It doesn't matter. And that is very emphatic from Madison. And, I mean, this is, you know, in some of these documents, he gets pretty colorful for Madison, because Madison was a very civil guy. And he was that way because of his nature, because he was a very small man in stature and kind of frail because of his health infirmities. So he was never one to actually be slinging insults at people. The only time that he kind of came across very, you know, rough around the edges was when he was dealing with the nullifiers, because that's what he was calling them. And he had very little respect for how they were perverting the Constitution. So anyway, all right, so that's Section 3. Let's dive into Section 4. Let's cover the very first part. So, Tammy, why don't you pick up the first part, and then, Sean, you can read the last part, because both of these, you know, are they're kind of the same, but they're separate, and I want to deal with them that way. So go ahead, Tammy.
Okay. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion.
Okay, so that's very clear that they're guaranteed a republican form of government. So if in your state you feel like the judiciary is coming upon you, and this is happening in the state of Washington, where the judiciary is inflicting great burdens. As a matter of fact, the state Supreme Court is basically telling all the counties they need to hire prosecuting attorneys so that they can do due process more quickly for the home and the indigent that need public attorneys. And it's not a problem. They're creating a problem, because what this will do is it will extend the labor costs onto the county to have to, you know, because lawyers are cheap, right? So this becomes a huge financial burden to all of these smaller counties, and this has been designed to destroy the county governments, to make them go bankrupt. That's what they're doing. And so that's not Republican in form. If you understand, we're supposed to be Republican in form, where we now have the judiciary ruling us. That's a judiciary form of government. So this is actually a First Amendment petition that needs to go to the federal government and make this plea, but it won't come from the state. So it has to come from the counties, and it won't, again, it won't come from the state legislature, because the state legislature is corrupt. So this has to become one of those viral things that we're trying to get enough people in the state of Washington to make a plea to the nation to please send Trump, send the forces in here to get rid of these people and give us our government back. Because Washington is literally being attacked by King Ferguson and his predecessor, King Inslee. So, Sean, go ahead and read this last part, because this actually identifies that there's an act or an involvement on the state side. So, in other words, this is a role and responsibility, and then there's the state role and responsibility. Go ahead.
And on the application of the legislature or of the executive when the legislature cannot be convened against any domestic violence.
Okay, against domestic violence. So what that means is if there's an invasion or an insurrection in the state, you know, can make an application of the state legislature, or I should say the federal government, when the state legislature says, come in and protect us from this insurgency or from this invasion. Mm-hmm. Now, previously, Sean,
which is what Texas tried to do, right, from being invaded?
I think Texas and Florida, yes, correct. Yeah, but this goes in hand with Article 1, Section 10. Right, Sean? Remember, we read that. And so, Tammy, you probably don't remember this, but if everybody goes back to Article 1, Section 10, and if you look at the very end of Section 3, it's the part that's in red with the yellow font, but I'm going to read the whole thing. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in times of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. In other words, when they actually apply in Article 4, Section 4, to Congress to basically say, hey, we need help, right here, they have the authority to engage in war because they're in imminent danger. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So this couples with Article 4, Section 4. As they apply, then they now, because they are now acknowledging that they are in danger, and because they're basically made it formal that, they, hey, we need your help, now they can start acting and defending themselves. Because technically they can't do it on their own. They actually have to call for the federal government to come in first. It's a part of that. So anyway, all right, so that's Article 4, and we've wrapped that up. Now we get Article 5. And so we got plenty of time, I think, to dive into this. And so this is broken into two paths, but, and it's kind of convoluted because you can see the highlights and so forth because there's, you know, it happens before this. But Sean, go ahead and read up to the very first part of amendments to this Constitution, and stop with the or, and then Tammy will dive into what basically Sean just read, and then you can read the rest or the next part, and then we can dive into, you know, this orange part. But go ahead, Sean, read that.
Do we
first
have time for a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Uh-huh. I think this is a sticking point for mm-hmm. a lot of people.
Yeah,
can you define, according to the framers, a republican form of government? What
yes.
exactly does that mean?
Well, so the way that they created the system under the Constitution, they created the exemplar republican form of government. By basic definition, a republican form of government is one that is representative. In other words, the people do not have legislative power. They basically vote for and obtain a representative to represent them in the making of laws and the, you know, taxation, those types of things, and delegate that power to them, the legislature. In this new form of government, they broke the legislature away from the magistrate, and they divided the magistrate's roles into an executive, judiciary, and the sovereign legislature, who are really those who create the law. They make law go away, and they tax us. So they were considered the sovereign. Now, in the federal Constitution, they went an extra step because it wasn't just representation of the people. The fundamental republican form of government is one that is representative of the people. In their extension of representation, they extended representation to the state government as well, because it had vested interest. That's why when we go through the Constitutional Convention, that was one of the biggest sticking points, that the state and its sovereignty needed to be protected, in addition to the people and their sovereignty. Therefore, they created a bicameral legislative body that represented the sovereigns in different houses. The House of Representatives represents the people and, you know, their sovereignty, their, you know, those things concerning the people. The Senate represents the state legislature and their sovereignty over those things that are important for the state legislature in governing their people. So there were two representatives for the state, one of the state legislature, or one body that represented the state legislature, and another body that represented the people. Ergo, it became a representative government, not of the people, but of the sovereigns. Technically, when we created this Declaration of Independence, we created the axiom that we the people institute government. The government is instituted by we the people. Right? By men. It says by men, but that basically means by we the people. So when we the people create a government, and this was the sticking point of the states in the Constitutional Convention, that, hey, we've been created to protect the sovereignty and our culture of what we have in a government and governing them, which is why the state government, the state's, you know, legal system, all of those things were, you know, untouchable by the federal government. They could not meddle with the states at all. So however they wanted to, you know, maintain or represent, as long as it was representative in form, that's all that mattered. Ultimately, what ended up happening is all the states recognize the superior form of creating a bicameral legislative body in representing the people of the county, as well as the people, or the legislature of the county. So that's why they created a Senate in all state houses, as well as they created a House of Representatives. Most states didn't even have legislatures like that. They were either unicameral or whatever. But all of the states were so different, but on their own, they actually dove into and followed the example of the U.S. Constitution. So they basically took it upon themselves to basically reconfigure themselves in the like manner of the U.S. Constitution. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the nuance between a Republican form of government today, based on how the states went down this path, is a representative of the sovereigns, not just the people, but the governments that the people created. And that's how they instituted their states. So, for the most part, when we actually look, and actually I could dive into the Washington State Constitution. We've got about 2 minutes, and I don't have time to do it now. But what I'm going to do, because I'm going to show you, when Washington State became a state in the Union, they actually followed the U.S. Constitution closer in creating the bicameral legislative body more than any other state. And I think it's worthy of showing. So what I'll do is I'll send it to both of you so you can kind of look at this. Because most states actually had the apportionment for the state Senate based on county. And when we look at how, you know, Washington did it, they actually ensured that the people of the county had representation in the House of Representatives as well. And so this is a real outlier when it comes to state constitutions. And the interesting thing is that Washington, when the Supreme Court did their shenanigans in reconfiguring all the state governments, they didn't touch their constitution. What they did was they put a little note that, oh, well, in our legal, in our laws or our code, in the Washington Code, we've, you know, made this note that we're not abiding by the Constitution. Well, they can't do that. They have to amend the Constitution to say they're not abiding by it. And so Washington pulled a fast one back in the 1860s or 1960s, 1970s, whenever they implemented this change, because they never changed the Constitution. They just ignored it and says, we're going to follow the Supreme Court's guidance and we're just going to put it into the code. You can't do that. You actually have to change. And I think everybody realized, at least Washington was one of the few states that realized, hey, because they've been amending their Constitution a lot in Washington. They go, you know what? The Supreme Court can't amend our Constitution. It's not in our Constitution to allow anybody but the people. So they went down this path of ignoring and so forth, which has actually created a hornet's nest. And so it's worthy of diving into when we convene in our next show, because we'll go through this so that everybody can see this. And then I think from that point, we can actually dive into the basic concept of a Republican form of government. So I'll get back into that to answer Sean's question, because it's not just representative. So anyway, we'll keep that key, we'll keep that focus, we'll start off on the Republican form of government and what Washington did, and kind of close on what is truly a Republican form of government under our Constitution and how the states kind of followed that. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley, we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.